Good afternoon, folks, and welcome to Alaska Gold Trails. I'm your host, Jim Madonna. This is your radio show on mining in Alaska, past, present, and future. More specifically, folks, gold mining in Alaska's mystery past, controversial present, and mysterious future. I'll be here with you on KFAR 660 on your radio dial each Thursday from 1 to 2 p.m., where we can discuss the entire spectrum of mining in Alaska. From the fascinating and colorful history of the major and minor gold rushes to the most recent gold prospecting and mining techniques. But one thing, folks, that I want you to understand very clearly, that if you'd like to talk to us here on Alaska Gold Trails, give us a call. Our number here is 479-8255. That's 479-TALK. Let's talk gold mining. Let's talk frontierism on Alaska Gold Trails. As I said a little earlier, folks, my guest today is Captain Jim Binkley, of Riverboat Discovery fame. And as many of you may know, today in Alaska Visitor's Guide, Discovery 3 is featured on the front page in full living color. So for those of you who are interested in river boating, I suggest you take a picture of that, and I want to welcome Jim Binkley to the show. Welcome to Alaska Gold Trails, Jim.
Jim Madonna, I'm delighted to be here.
Well, Jim, I want to, right off the bat here, I want to, we have a call, and I think maybe one of your friends might like to talk to you.
Sure.
So with that in mind, let's see if we can hit the phone.
Oh, okay. Thank you. Captain Binkley.
Yes.
I've been waiting for your show. I have a couple of questions for you. Hope you can make a comment and an explanation.
Surely.
And this has to do with the aspect of steamboating on the Yukon. The first question that I wonder if you could address was the procedure, how it worked, of, I'll call it grasshoppering over shallow places with the big pole, like stilts in front.
Mm-hmm.
And the second one was, could you address, maybe comment, and explain winching up through the, I believe, Five Finger Rapids, if I'm not mistaken.
Yes. All right.
I'll hang up at this.
Surely. Well, the phrase you use, grasshoppering, we call that sparring off. And when one is stuck on a sandbar, there are any number of ways to attempt to get off. And the sticking on a sandbar can be a pretty serious thing because you lose a lot of time for the company you're working for, and of course that relates to money. So the sooner you can get that off, the better. Ordinarily, you're pushing a barge, or two, or even three, and the boat usually comes off first. Then you can help get the barges off once you've got the boat free and up against the riverbank. But the procedure that you talk about are the two big spars, look like big utility poles, on each side of, for example, the steamer Nenana. Those were lifted and dumped over the side, sticking down in the sand, straight upright. Then a tackle was attached to the deck, and using the winch, you would actually lift the bow of the boat. And while you did that, you gave a shot of power, gave the engineer a ring and told him to give it a shot, and he would give a kick with the stern wheel, which, of course, is above the bottom of the boat, so it pushes the boat ahead. So you've lifted the front of the boat. Only the stern is sticking. The power of the wheel gives you a shot, and you move ahead about 6 feet. Then you retrieve those spars and put them upright again, lift yourself another time, and push yourself ahead. A tremendous amount of work for the deck crew. Didn't always work, but when it did work, it was terrific. Winching through the rapids was something that we had to do occasionally when we were not didn't have power enough to push up against the current. So we'd run a small boat ahead, take out a line, fasten it to a convenient tree or trees if necessary, bring that line back to the boat, put it through what we call the fairlead out in the front so that we'd have the line coming straight to the winch. And then the pilot or the captain, whomever was steering, would hold the boat offshore in a convenient place, then you start to pull. So you'd winch yourself up over the swift spots. In Five Finger that you talked about, it was a little different there because they had a cable already fastened to the rocks above and below the swift spot. I had a lot of slack in it. And you came up alongside on the downstream side and picked up the cable, put the slack on deck, wrapped it around your capstan, And with the steam pressure against the captain's, you would take a tight pull on the line, pull yourself up through the swift spot. When you got to the point where the boats had sufficient power to push against the current, you'd unwind it from the capstan, throw it over the side, and continue on your way. So that covers those two.
Jim, our caller referenced Five Fingers Rapids. Are we referring to the Five Finger Rapids?
That latter part in the upper Yukon, Jim.
Between Whitehorse and Dawson?
Five Finger was the most dramatic one, the one that got the most publicity because it looked so difficult and it wasn't all that tough. Rink Rapids, just below Five Finger Rapids, killed several steamers in the early days. As a matter of fact, my dad had some very harrowing experiences in Rink Rapids back at the, 1898, 1899.
Did your father go all the way up to Lake Bennett? I don't want to get ahead of the program here, but just since we're on the subject.
Well, he started at Lake Bennett. He walked over the White Pass when he was just a young man and carried 2,000 pounds of gear on his back. It took him about a month to get up there. And he built a boat at Lake Bennett out of whipsawed lumber, like so many did. But he had a kind of an advantage because he'd been trained as a pilot on the Ohio River. He was born in Indiana, born on the farm, but he was always attracted to boats and machinery and that sort of thing. So he trained as a riverboat pilot. He was a Cub pilot on the Ohio. He heard about the furor in Alaska and he headed out toward the Pacific coast, arrived in Seattle in 1897, and made a stake and got himself the gear, put himself on a boat, and off he went. So we started really at Lake Bennett the spring of 1898.
So then your father had a lot of experience through all the rapid areas, Miles Canyon, Whitehorse Rapids, and...
Miles Canyon was probably the most dramatic one. Those people who have seen it know that it is a pretty dramatic canyon where all the water from the lakes that come down that side of the watershed in Canada gather up into Marsh Lake, and Marsh Lake empties out into what is now the Yukon through a canal of rocks. Maybe in those days it was as much as 150 feet high and probably not much wider than that. So it was really a flume of water going through there. Many miners were lost in there. Some of them didn't want to take their rafts through, so they would portage around it, which was expensive and difficult. But my dad would charge from $25 to $100 to take rafts through. And to get the money to build his first steamboat, that's the way he did it.
Why don't we see what kind of questions we've got here for you.
You bet.
Hello?
Yes, I was on the phone just a few minutes ago, but I have one more question that Captain McPhee brought up. And that has to do with the where the Yukon starts. First trip I ever made over the highway, the river running out of Marsh Lake was the L-E-W-E-S. My question is, how did they pronounce it? Was the Lewes or the Lewis?
It was the Lewes River at that time. And the beginning of the Yukon listed at that time was where the White and the Pelly River came together.
Right. Well,
and that was officially the Yukon. But then in the days we had visitors coming up here, they wanted to see the Yukon. Whitehorse wanted to take advantage of that, so they just extended the source of the Yukon up to Marsh Lake. Took away the sign that said Lewes River and called it the Yukon. You're right on.
Thank you.
Did you, in your early day, when was it that your father was running 1898?
He was running
in the feeling that
the Whitehorse Dawson area, Jim, that he was running in those days. And there were plenty of big steamboats on the river coming all the time. There were just a lot of boats hauling freight to the miners. And he discovered that he could do better by working on the side streams. So he met a man who has become a very famous Alaskan character, Sid Barrington, who was my godfather, by the way. And he and Sid became partners, and they built small boats and operated on the side streams. And they followed all the gold strikes. Whenever there was a strike, they were right there with their small boats. Now, in order to get up some of these streams, they had to use a propeller boat instead of a sternwheeler. And my dad did not invent the idea, but he built the first tunnel stern boats west of the Mississippi River. And they were very successful in hauling tons and tons of freight up the very, very shallow side streams to the mining sites. And in those days, they got paid off in gold dust. Had their gold scales right with them.
Maybe I'd like to ask you a couple more questions about some of the boating that went on in interior and Yukon at that time, right after these messages.
Keepsakes and snapshots, old clocks and dogs, hanging up pictures, stacking up logs. Everyday people are making new friends, and it's starting to feel like home. Getting settled in, life's looking better than it's ever been before. Our new home and dreams, it's what we've been waiting for.
Call your real estate agent today about affordable HUD homes.
Where can you get something free? Why, at Country Kitchen in Washington Plaza. Nothing gets your day off to a better start than a delicious cup of gourmet coffee. And when you're a member of Country Kitchen's Coffee Club, you can enjoy a full pound of any of their 47 varieties of coffee, including decaffeinated and flavored coffees, free. Just join the coffee club, and after you buy a total of 7 pounds of coffee, they'll give you a pound of your choice free. That's the Country Kitchen in Washington Plaza Mall.
When you want the best deal, it's the one place to be. See it before Lincoln Mercury.
Fairbanks knows where the best deals are. We've got your brand new car.
That's why people everywhere still come here to see it before Lincoln Mercury. The best deal anywhere is right here. I think it's for Lincoln Mercury.
Jim, perhaps we ought to start at the beginning. A lot of times we get ahead of ourselves here and everything gets so interesting that somehow we forget to ask that question of, like, where was Jim Binkley born? When was Jim Binkley born? What kind of life did Jim Binkley have? And I think we ought to ask a few of those questions just to build a foundation for us here.
Okay,
where were you born,
Jim? I was born in Wrangell in Alaska, in southeastern Alaska, about halfway between Ketchikan and Juneau. Little lumber town, fishing town, mostly fishing in those days. I was born in 1920, and my dad had established with his partner a business on the Stikine River, hauling freight to the miners up in British Columbia. They had incidentally been on the shores at Ship Creek at a place that eventually was called Anchorage, where they were bringing surveyors in to survey for the town and also up the Susitna to survey for the Alaska Railroad in the beginning. And the government took over, and they had to move, so they moved to the Stikine River and started there, and that was where I was born. My dad died when I was just very young, and my two uncles, who were rivermen, took over my river education. I spent 3 years in high school in California, staying with my maternal grandparents.
Did you have your introduction to riverboats and riverboating before you went to high school in California?
Well, to a certain extent, yes. I wasn't getting paid for it.
But there was some excitement and enchantment around it.
Oh, of course. Absolutely. But my first real experience came after I got out of high school and got serious about it. I decided I wanted to follow that career because it was a family tradition. You see, my paternal grandfather had logged and rafted logs on the Ohio River also, which was one of the ways my dad got started. So to me, it seemed like a kind of a family tradition. And it's an exciting, exciting business. And I wanted to get in that wheelhouse as fast as I could, but I spent plenty of time in the engine room and plenty of time in the galley and plenty of time on deck until I finally got up there and became a pilot.
Well, tell us about what do you do in the engine room? What kind of engine room were you talking
about?
Well,
two different things. We had internal combustion engines that were running boats in those days and also steam-powered. And I was fortunate in getting started in the very earliest days of steam when they were still burning wood here in the interior. I left Wrangell in late 39, early 40 to come to Fairbanks to attend the university. And, of course, got a job right away because I'd had some river experience. And as what I wanted to do, and I worked for the late Captain George Black, who operated out of Fairbanks for years. And I operated 3 years between Fairbanks and Dawson on the mail run, 2,000-mile round trip. We'd sometimes turn around at Eagle and sometimes go on up to Dawson. But that was an exciting time, and that's where I got my first stern wheel piloting experience. And in World War II, I was really very fortunate because I was moved from boat to boat, got the kind of experience that would take you a lifetime to get, really in just a few years. I piloted from small tugboats with a two-man crew to the big steamer Klondike out of Whitehorse with a 50-man crew in those days. So during wartime, they put on extra help, and we carried big, big loads of freight down the Yukon to Circle, which eventually came around into Fairbanks. So that kind of extends the type of experience that I had. But probably the most glorious of it all, those earlier days from 1940 through the beginning of World War II here in the interior, to me, were just super exciting. I developed a tremendous admiration and respect for the native cultures here in the interior, watching those self-reliant, proud people in those days and the way they carried on their families, their family associations, the trapping that they did in the villages in those days to me were just a great delight.
You got a big feeling for the country in that respect.
Oh, my, I should say so. You know, the hours alone in the wheelhouse way up high like that, particularly up in the Arctic, where at midnight the sun is right on the horizon, and it's putting those purple fingers out through the trees and the snow on the high mountains, having those purple shadows coming down, and that power of the boat going against the current and that total peace that's involved there. It's a life that it's hard to describe unless you've experienced it.
Let's see who we've got on the air here, Jim. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi, I know you brought Discovery 3 up on a barge to the mouth of the Yukon, sunk the barge, and drove the boat up here under its own power. How were the old ones brought up into Alaska?
That's a neat question, because that in itself is a real Alaskan story. Many of the boats were built in Seattle and knocked down condition, shipped up by barge and assembled at Unalaska and also right near the mouth of the Yukon, St. Michael, put together at that point. Some were built by the Moran Company in Seattle in the earliest days, and they came up under their own power. The attrition rate on those was pretty high. But those earliest boats, some of those were built at Whitehorse by old Scotch shipbuilders whom I used to take great delight in watching in the springtime as the boats were being fitted out and ready for the summer. But that's the system on that. Now, some boats were built here. The earliest one built here in Fairbanks, I think, was about 1910, something like that, the steamer Idler, which I served on in 1940. And the wheelhouse from that boat is now for the wheelhouse on Discovery Number 1. So we've been able to preserve a little bit of that history. Discovery 1, of course, we built in our backyard right here on University Avenue in 1955. And Discovery Number 2 was the steamer Utana that had belonged to the Captain George Black estate. We took it and converted it. It looks nothing like the original boat, but some of the original material is still in it. Well, that's a bit of Alaska's real history there.
So we can safely figure that taking a sternwheeler or a riverboat across the Gulf of Alaska was not a low-risk project.
Indeed. As a matter of fact, we gave serious consideration to running Discovery Number 3 under our own power up here, and that is feasible to do. But the expense involved in doing that was greater than doing it on a barge, and the insurance premium on bringing it up under your own power as opposed to on the barge was terrifying.
Thank
More
you.
So than the conditions.
Okay, thank you.
You're welcome.
Hi, you're on the air.
Yes, when you're running down the channel, a lot of times you'll send out a pilot boat and find the bars in the channel, and you put buoys out next to the bar sandbar. Is that, which side of the bar does that go on, or the channel? Does it change if you're going up and downstream?
It depends on the conditions. If I understand what you mean, if you're coming downstream with a load of freight, there are points that you simply must cut very close without sticking the barges as you have freight coming on there. So you place those in a particular point, which gives you just a reference point for turning. And it's marking the channel in the best position for the pilot. Coming upstream, we rarely put out buoys. Most of the time it was going down. And then we would retrieve them because that buoy might be on dry land when you came back as much as 2 weeks later. But the position of the buoy was determined by the pilot and the man in the sounding boat as to what they wanted as a reference point where they had to turn so they wouldn't be swept down on a bar. So it was a matter of just making up your mind right on the spot as to what was the most favorable spot for it.
Right. It wouldn't necessarily, channel wouldn't necessarily be on the right or the left.
Not at all. No. The wind conditions are something else, too. You see, those boats were subject to, and ours now, subject to wind is a tremendous factor to us because there's a small amount in the water and a tremendous sail area up above. And when that wind hits you, you have to determine just how much power you put against it. And then if the wind suddenly dies, you have to be prepared to die right with it. So that marker would depend on the current, the bar, and the wind, those combinations.
We were coming up last year, and you were going down, and the first two markers that you had out, we cut on the left side, and we thought we had it made. The next one we cut on the left side, and we were high and dry. So I thought maybe there was a...
No, the only system is the one that's determined by the two pilots that are doing the pilot boat and the steering at the time to their best advantage. So there's
right.
No real system.
Well, with
to
your
it.
Radio communications, you can figure it out easy enough. Okay, thank you, Captain.
Yes, you're welcome.
Jim, I want to get back with you in just a few minutes and talk a whole lot more about river boating. And I also want to let the listening audience know that they can give you a call here at 479-TALK. That's 479-8255. But in between then and now, I'd like to tell the folks out there about a couple of the people who take care of us here and make certain that we can offer Alaska Gold Trails to the people of interior Alaska. And one of those people, of course, is Gabe's Truck and Auto. And I don't know, perhaps I should give a personal testimony here. I've been working with Gabe's Truck and Auto for perhaps 6 or 7 years now, and it was long before I ever started Alaska Gold Trails, and it was quite a surprise to me to find out that Gabe's Truck and Auto was one of the sponsors of this particular program. And ever since Gabe's has sponsored us, they have been very pleased with the fact that they were a member of this unique group that has offered the frontier experiences to all of the interior of Alaska. So I always like to tell people who they are, where they are, and what they do. And, of course, Gabe's Truck and Auto is located at 2058 Donald Road. More people recognize the fact that they are just off Van Horn Road near Metro Field. And their phone number is 456-6156. In addition to that, what do they do? Well, they do just about everything to an automobile that can be done to an automobile to put it in perfect operating condition. They have engines, new and rebuilt engines. They have IM inspections, of course. In fact, the matter is, Gabe's and Truck and Auto are the people who initiated the concept of no pass, no pay. That's right. If you don't pass, you don't pay at Gabe's Truck and Auto. And we don't want to overlook the fact that Gabe's also has three large tow trucks available 24 hours a day to serve you. So if you need a tow, give them a call. Once again, their number is 456-6156. And tell them that you heard about them from Jim on Alaska Gold Trails. I have one other sponsor here I'd like to just talk about briefly, one of my favorites. That's B&L Pawn Shop at the corner of Gaffney and Cushman. And many times I said that B&L Pawn Shop is one of the most unpredictable stores in Fairbanks, Alaska. It's a variety store that cannot be equaled anywhere. They have everything you could possibly think of. They have cameras, they have TVs, they have radios, typewriters, and hats, musical instruments, propane bottles, tools, just, in fact, the list goes on and on. You can get anything at B&L Pawn. Where are they located? Once again, they're at the corner of Gaffney and Cushman. And they have a friend. I have a friend over there. Her name is Killer. If you'd like to stop in and say hello to Killer, I'm certain that she might be so surprised and so pleased that you dropped by and said hello that she might sweeten any kind of deal that you might have in your mind. So stop in, tell Killer you heard her ad on Alaska Gold Trails, and she'll sweeten the deal. And by the way, if you'd like to give them a phone call, their number is 452-6491. And once again, ladies and gentlemen, we're here on KFAR Radio 660 on your radio dial. My guest this afternoon on Alaska Gold Trails is Captain Jim Binkley, and we'd like to say hello. You're on the air.
Yes. One more question, Captain Binkley. Captain Binkley, you were in the transition period between steam and internal combustion. I wonder if you'd comment on the handling characteristics, all of the considerations aside, steam versus internal.
Sure. I think I could probably do it in this manner. The steamboats were very large because the wheel had to grow in size as the power of the boat was increased. With an internal combustion, you merely added more propellers and more engines. You just had the same small crew and a relatively small boat. So the steamboat, the more power you had, the bigger it got to contain the wheel and the power applied to it. So the difference was that the big boat was just very, very difficult to handle. One characteristic that was terrific, it has tremendous backing power, which is what you need when you're handling freight going downstream in a tough river like the Tanana, for example. And that, to me, was always a joy because you could back it in either direction with the big flanking rudders that responded to the reverse power of that wheel. With the propeller boats, though, you had differential power where you could use one engine and go ahead and another one in backup or any combination of several. So I guess the difference was there was a lot of romance in the steamboat and a lot of hard work in the propeller boat, but I liked them both. I think I have a more nostalgic feeling about the steamboat because it was just so much fun to be on a part of Alaska in the United States past. A tugboat is just a tugboat no matter what. You get a good feeling for it. But the old steamboats, there's just something in your mind and your heart that's so much different than a regular tugboat.
Well, I see. Perhaps I phrased my question wrong. I was just wondering in terms of the paddle wheel boats, were you in the transition of them from steam to...
For personally making the transition?
Yeah.
Yeah, a little difficult. Not all that bad, though, because fortunately for me, I got to move around a lot. Ordinarily, a person would be a pilot and then a captain on a boat, and it would take almost a lifetime. And a mate would be waiting for years to get to be able to handle a boat and become a pilot. But in the utility role that I played, I just moved around from boat to boat. And it really wasn't too difficult for me to make the transition from a big steamer down to a small tug. Relatively easy, although I must confess to answer your problem, some of the fellows did have a lot of trouble doing that. Somehow it was relatively easy for me, because the whole thing was just a lot of fun no matter what I was doing.
Well, I'll phrase it one more way. In terms of steam, you've got maximum torque at zero RPM, whereas an internal combustion engine is different. And I was just wondering as to the responsiveness of steam versus the internal combustion.
No difference.
No difference.
Because internal combustion was applied several ways. Internal combustion engine would be applied to run a generator, which run an electric motor, which could turn your paddle wheel, or a hydraulic system that would turn your paddle wheel, or a direct connection. And the response was just as fast as steam. Although I must say I miss the smell of cylinder oil and steam. I used to take a piece of oakum and stick it under my pillow at night.
Wonder what old trainmen put under there.
I wonder.
Thank you.
You bet.
Thank
you. I'm getting confused here. There's all kinds of wheels on these boats, Jim. They got them on the sides and they got them on the back. And
yes.
Yeah, tell me something about that.
Well, the side-wheelers were never successful here because of two reasons. One, you couldn't work as close to shore as you want to in these rivers, or you want to get in tight to save time. You get right into the brush with the paddle wheel way behind your back there that was in the safest position. And the side-wheeler, if you had lifted it over to one side, you'd lose power on the other side. So the stern-wheeler was more successful. With a propeller boat, you had the propellers underneath the hull up in a tunnel, and you had the small propellers, and you had to be more careful of those in the snags and sticks and trees that you went over than you did with a stern wheeler. So you had three types, the paddle wheeler with the side wheels, that with a stern wheel, and then the regular propellers on the boat you would visualize today. That help?
That helped a little bit.
Good.
Yeah. We're starting to get this cleared up. I do have a couple of announcements before I go into the announcement. What I want to do when we come back is I want to talk about what you did in terms of developing discovery through the years.
I got a little story that'll go with that other one, too, as soon as you have time, Jim. The transition from...
Oh, well, let's have the story
propeller
now.
To steam. I had a big twin-screw propeller boat that I was operating on the river, and the military had one of the old-time mates come over and work with me, and I asked if he wanted to stand a shift, and he said, sure. So he was accustomed to a paddle wheel. Of course, we had none on that boat, and he couldn't remember for sure what power he was applying to the engines through his signals, so he said to one of the deckhands, hey, run back and see what kind of way the wheel is turning. And the deckhand came back and he said, there's no wheel back there. That transition was a little difficult for him.
You make it difficult for me to give an ad, Jim.
Go for it anyway.
GTE presents the Silver Anniversary Ball, honoring the 25th anniversary of the Fairbanks North Star Borough this Saturday, May 27th, Westmark Hotel. No host cocktails and hors d'oeuvres at 6:30, a fashion show by LTD at 8, and dance the night away from 9 p.m. on to the music of Sandcastle. Attire semi-formal, tickets $12.50, available at Gerald Victor Furs, Owltree, Big Eye, Main Street, Craig Ricks, Super Values, City Manager's Office, MUS, Borough Mayor's Office, Peg's Place, or call 452-4761 between 10 and 5.
Each morning during Problem Corner, hear all the latest developments live from Valdez, Monday through Saturday with Pat Lynn and Kerry Anderson. They'll bring you up to date on the latest inside details on the oil spill, what's being done and how. The Valdez Report, every morning during Problem Corner in the 10 o'clock hour. It's brought to you live in the public interest by Rothmeyer Optical in West Valley Plaza and by Jean's Chrysler Plymouth Dodge at 1804 South Cushman.
I'd like to take a minute to let all my friends here in the interior of Alaska know about the Days Inn Motel in Anchorage, Alaska. Whether you're traveling for business or pleasure, at the Days Inn Anchorage, you can expect personal service, quality accommodations, and affordable rates. Some of the conveniences that you will expect to find at the Days Inn include an airport limousine, airport courtesy telephone, a 24-hour restaurant, free local calls, and get this, an exercise facility, and of course, a lounge. Now, Days Inn is located, centrally located, at 321 East 5th Avenue. That's 5th and Cordova in Anchorage, Alaska. For reservations, you need but to call their toll-free number at 1-800-325-2525. Once again, their toll-free number is 1-800-325-2525. And tell them you heard
Willow
about
Wood.
Them from Jim on Alaska Gold Trails right here on KFAR Radio.
Okay, Jim, we're ready to start the adventure with... With your romance in river boating starting with Discovery One?
We started with the Godspeed. That was our first small boat. No, stern wheel romancing, yes. Discovery One was the genesis of that. The Godspeed we purchased from the former Episcopal Bishop here in Fairbanks, and that's the way Mary and I got our start. And that was a 25-passenger boat. We could see immediately that we were going to need a larger one. So I had a friend of mine help me design that, a fellow who was a professional architect. And that was built right in our backyard on University Avenue, launched in the Noyes Slough in 1955. Now, at that time, it carried 49 passengers. And again, the same situation. Business was growing, so I cut it in half and stretched it out, made it longer, and then we got up to 80 passengers. And then I wanted twice that many later on, so I widened it out 8 feet and made it again a little bit longer. That accommodated 150 passengers. When we got up to the point of talking to the Coast Guard about making it larger again, they said, hey, hold up here. You can only go so far with that. So we purchased the old boat from Nenana that I had worked on years ago that traveled so many thousands of miles of the Yukon. We purchased it from the George Black estate and we converted it to what is now Discovery Number 2. I went through the same situation there. We made it wider and longer through the years until we could no longer do that. Then our family made the decision to build Discovery Number 3, which has been just eminently successful. It's a beautiful, beautiful boat. Probably the most sophisticated, Jim, the most sophisticated sternwheeler riverboat ever built. And still an old-fashioned sternwheeler.
You had quite an adventure bringing that up when you sunk the barge and then
yes.
Mm-hmm. You brought that. You had somebody actually do a videotape of that entire trip, didn't you?
Yes, so we did. As a matter of fact, Princess Tours sponsored that, and they hired a Hollywood crew, really a fine professional gang to come up with it. And the photographer who did the photography, Bill Farnsworth, is a well-known Hollywood cameraman. And the young guy who did the storyline of the whole thing is an advertising person, one who incidentally worked for us years ago, a neat young man whose father is an advertising man in Hollywood. And they did a superb job on that, just mm-hmm. grand. They took it from the time that it came off the boat, and then they did their research on the old days, and what they did was to interview people along the river and get their impressions about what has happened since those earlier days, the old folks mm-hmm. particularly, and what were their feelings seeing this big sternwheeler coming up the river. They interviewed kids and older folks, the Eskimo cultures on the coast and the Indian cultures. They came close to the interior. And then, of course, the arrival in Fairbanks. And I had no part in that, incidentally. I turned that over to our two sons, oldest and youngest. Number two son and daughter and Mary and I ran the operation here while they went down to the mouth of the Yukon and took the boat off and brought her all the way home. Really a outstanding accomplishment to do that. Just the trip alone, 3,500 miles by barge, was quite a situation. We had to put it on the barge ourselves and cradle it. And number one son schemed all that out, did the whole works.
When you came up to Nenana,
then we encountered the bridges.
That's right. You know, that was kind of interesting. You actually hinged that stack over, didn't you?
Let me tell you how that occurred. I had made that run years ago. I've run all the way from Dawson clear down to the Bering Sea and almost all the side streams in between through the years, and I felt it'd be a great adventure for two of the boys, at least, to be able to bring that thing up here, and they could encounter the same kinds of things that I did and have the same surprise and marvelous feelings that I had. And I've
good.
Done it already.
Good.
Why should I do it again?
Mm-hmm.
So what I did was to do a briefing with them. We sat down and we took my old charts and so on, and we took every portion of the river and what they were likely to encounter. Of course, many changes since those years. But as we did that, we got to Nenana, and I said, wait a minute, we got to go under two bridges here. And then I recalled that the steamer Nenana had to do the same thing. So the boys went down, and actually, there are records about the height of the bridge above the water, but we got to know exactly. So they went down, and they dropped the plumb line down, and actually, on the ice, measured the exact height above the ice line. They compared that to the water records at Nenana, so they knew at any given time how much clearance they would have. So we had to hinge that stack, take the whole thing apart. And there are one, two, three, four exhaust pipes that come up through there. It's actually a functional stack. So the exhaust system had to be modified to take that, too. But it worked very well. Below Nenana, they just took the bolts loose, lowered the stack, went under there. And the beautiful thing is they went under the bridge at Nenana, the train bridge, at exactly the same moment a train was going south across the top of the bridge. And that's part of that film, Path of Gold, which incidentally is played on PBS. Marvelous, marvelous film.
We've heard a lot about your adventures as a riverboat captain. How about your private life? You talk about your sons, you talk about your wife. I think we should go back maybe a couple of years here anyway to perhaps the scene that surrounded your meeting of Mary. Would you run through that a little bit for us, Jim?
Sure, I'd be delighted to. There's an interesting story that goes with that, if we have time to go through it here, Jim, but after I was discharged from the service, my mother and my stepfather were living up above Eagle on the Canadian border, and I got out of the service in January and could hardly wait to get up there. And I incidentally had piloted boats in the Bering Sea, in the Gulf of Alaska in the Aleutian Chain on the Yukon River, all of Prince William Sound, the whole works in the period that I've been in the military. I had tremendous experience on a variety of vessels, small troop ships, right down to the biggest riverboat in the business, the steamer Klondike at that time. Never on the Nenana, I never had that privilege, but I worked alongside it for a long time. Well, when I was out of the service, I wanted to get home, and I flew up to Eagle with the bush pilot. This was in 1946, and I borrowed a dog team from an Indian friend of mine at the Eagle Village and mushed down up to see my parents, my mother and my stepfather. And unbeknownst to me, the weather was changing. A cold front was moving in, and as I left Eagle, it was about zero, but I hadn't been out of an hour that the cold weather was creeping up on me, and it got down to about 48, 49 below. The dogs wouldn't work, and I didn't know enough to slow down. I was excited anyhow. And I breathed in so much of that dry, cold air that I actually did what they call, quote, freezing your lungs, which is merely a dry pneumonia where all the bronchi in your bronchiary collapse. And it's a very serious situation. Fortunately for me, my mother is a nurse, so when I got to the camp, she immediately saw that there was something wrong with me, the way I was breathing. And the dogs were okay because they just wouldn't work at all, and I did all the pushing on the sled. Muster is usually the hardest working dog in the team anyhow. But at any rate, I was becoming cyanotic. My lips were blue and my fingernails and so on. I just was absolutely struggling for breath. And she gave me injections of adrenaline to dilate my capillaries. But she had to give me so much that it would make my heart skip a beat. So they had to get me out of there in a hurry. And the Indians from the village and the villagers cleared off a spot where a bush pilot friend of mine, by the name of Johnny Lynn in those days, flew in an old blanket and flew me out. And I was in the hospital here in Fairbanks for about a month. And they gave me penicillin, this sort of thing. But then I wanted to go back to the university and stayed with a friend of mine who was the superintendent of maintenance there. And that's where I met Mary when I was convalescing from the hospital and living with my friend Jack Sullivan, who was the engineer. And she would come with another girl and clean the apartment there periodically. So I spotted her at the bottom of the stairs and I said, hey, my prayers have been answered. Well, I suggested to her a few days after we had met that it would be appropriate for us to get married. By gosh, it took me about a year to talk her into it. I was in the Veterans Hospital in Portland, Oregon for several months as a result of that, and she lived in that area.
For some reason, she found her way down to that area during this period of time?
Yes, indeed. She somehow our paths were parallel.
What a coincidence.
Indeed it was.
Yeah.
Well, anyway, finally she succumbed and said, okay. And I, of course, had visions of our living in a log cabin with a pitcher pump and an outhouse and this sort of thing, but it simply didn't work out that way.
You got some new directions, did you?
Yes, I did.
Well, that's great. That was quite a story. Following that period of time, how many children do you have?
We have four. We have a daughter and three sons.
And they're all interested in?
All working at it. Marilee, our daughter, handles all the marketing and sales and our gift shop situation on our boat. And Jim handles all the personnel and the cosmetics, and Skip handles all of the mechanical details, and I'm now chairman of the board, and he is president of the company. Our son John, who works with us in the summertime, as most people know, is a state senator. We had a boating operation over on the Kuskokwim. That was John's operation. He was running that, and he became a senator from that area, and he is serving in that capacity now. But he'll be here very shortly and be working with us here in the course of the summer, and we'll have everybody, including our 10-year-old grandson, our oldest of eight.
That'll be great.
And we all, you know, we're all uniformed these days in our tourist business, and our grandson who works on board has a uniform with a half a stripe.
Half a stripe.
Absolutely. Oh, you got to start somewhere.
That's right. Jim, I want to get back with you in a minute and talk a little bit more about what is available on the boat and what people can expect to see right after a couple of announcements. I'd like to talk about one of my friends, one of my very, very good old-time friends here in Alaska, and that's Hector's Welding, located at 13 Mile Richardson Highway. And as many of you know, especially many of the people in the mining community know, Hector's been serving Alaska for many years. He's got a 14,400 square foot shop, which is capable of demanding the most demanding work quickly and efficiently. And let me just say a few things from recent memory. I recently remember Hector developing one of the most well-constructed sluicing and trommel operations in the interior of Alaska. And that particular operation is being run by Polar Mining out near Esther, Alaska. And that is probably one of the most efficient sluicing systems that we have in the state. And this, of course, was built by Hector. In addition to that, I'd like to also point out that all miners, especially placer miners, know that you have to have the right equipment for the right job. And it's because of that the internal portion of the sluicing system have the proper riffles and gold entrapment system within it in order to most efficiently attract the gold particles that might come their way, especially when we're considering the fine gold particles, which contribute so much to the economy of the mining operation. Hector's specializes in fabricating this particular type of equipment. So if you're interested in gold extraction equipment at the highest possible level, stop out at Hector's Welding and talk to the folks out there. They're located at 13 Mile Richardson Highway. Their phone number is 488-6432. Once again, for those of you who are interested in starting a mining operation this year and want to talk gold entrapment equipment, the number is 488-6432. That's Hector's Welding, located at 13 Mile Richardson Highway. There's a couple of other spots that I'd like to take care of right now. One of them that is a lot of fun to do every week is probably the what I would consider one of the newest sponsors that I have, although he's been with me all 2 years. He didn't realize that I'd gone back on the air this fall, and as soon as he found out, he demanded to be put back on the show, and that was Robbie Ginther. And you know Robbie Ginther as the general manager of Tip Top Chevrolet Buick, which is located at 1916 South Cushman Street. The phone number over there is 452-8211, but I don't only want to talk about Robbie today. I mean, I talk about Robbie all the time, and a lot of people say, well, why don't you talk about me? So I'll talk about Jim Brown. He's a sales manager over there. So if you want a little information regarding new car sales, talk to Jim Brown. And if it's used car sales, well, it's a different chap. That's Elmer Osbloom, who's over there taking care of the used cars. And service manager, Randy Meadows. You need some repairs on your Chevrolet Buick or some information regarding some service, ask Randy Meadows. He's the man on the job over there at Tip Top Chevrolet Buick. And in the body shop, the manager is Randy Mayhew. And he's been with Tip Top Chevrolet Buick for 6 years. By the way, folks, all of these people have been with Tip Top Chevrolet Buick for many, many years. They're a hometown run organization. They keep their employees. Their employees are happy. Happy employees are going to give you good service. Stop over there. Tell Robbie that Jim sent you, would you? Thanks a lot. Hi, you're on the air.
Would you ask Jim what he has planned tomorrow for the senior citizens at Fairbanks? No, hang up and listen.
Oh, I'd be delighted to answer that. Tomorrow's a very special day. As you probably realize, that we haul literally hundreds of little school kids in the springtime is a kind of a nice treat for them, and we just love to do it. And we have a special one that we're doing tomorrow at 1:30 for the physically challenged at Denali Center, the Pioneers Home, the seniors from the Senior Center in Fairbanks, the Nanya Seniors, the North Pole Seniors, and the Fairbanks Native Association Senior Center. And this will depart tomorrow at 1:30. So all of the folks who are aware of that, check with the Senior Centers, and they'll give you all the dope if you don't understand what's going on. But this is a time of year when we try to do as much for the local people who wouldn't have that opportunity otherwise as we can until we start right into our regular season, which incidentally starts on Saturday. We have a trip this afternoon that I'll be jumping into here very shortly. We have Friday, the senior citizen group and the physically handicapped, and then on Saturday we start our regular 8:45, 2 p.m. double trip day all summer long.
Jim, give us a little information. You said you have Discovery 1, Discovery 2,
and Discovery 3. Yes.
Where is Discovery 1 right now?
Discovery 1 is on our dry dock right now. We have our own dry dock, one we built from surplus 48-inch pipe, and we're doing some changes and repairs on it. But we must have enough backup for the big boat so that we can never interrupt our schedule. Discovery number 2, for example, made over 4,000 consecutive voyages without 5 minutes delay, which is a pretty remarkable record for any piece of mechanical equipment. However, if we're going to keep a schedule and accommodate all of our visitors here and our obligations, we must have backup in the event that we have a mechanical problem. So Discovery number 2 and Discovery number 1 are backups to Discovery number 3. But there's something else I'd like to say while we still have the time here, Jim, if I may, is about the steamer Nenana in town. That really is a treasure. And I have much admiration and respect for Jim Jack Williams and his group that's doing the work on the steamer Nenana. And the interest that's being generated by the school kids on that marvelous, marvelous old vessel. I enjoy listening to Gail Malloy in the morning and the young people who are are asking these trivia questions and so on, the answers to which I know very well, and I'm always tempted to punch the button and call in, but I know that I shouldn't do that.
No fair,
but,
Jim.
I'm sure. No fair. Sure. But really, it just thrills me to see that steamboat coming back alive
the
again.
The trivia question this morning was what...
Well, the hogging system.
Hogging.
Right.
Right. Mm-hmm. What's a hogging, Jim?
Well, the boat sagging is when the boat sags in the middle. Hogging is when it falls down on each end, sags on each end. So you put a big post in the center and run cables out to the ends to hold it up. You've got the machinery on each one end and the boilers on the other, so it's not to sag down there.
Well, we've got the answer.
Okay, fine.
Hi, you're on the air with Jim Beekman.
Hello. I'd like to ask Jim a question, please.
Sure.
Jim?
Yes.
I remember you in Nenana, the fall of 1945. You were in the service. What boat were you on?
On the Hazel B number 2. I was captain of that vessel. It was a 100-foot twin-screw tug and carried 35 passengers, and I could push about 250 tons of freight.
Yeah, I remember you well.
Oh, my. Well, those are glorious days, and I have a lot of very, very fond memories of my times in Nenana and down to Galena, even clear down to the mouth and clear up the Eagle.
Yeah, I'm going to be on your boat tomorrow.
Wonderful. I'll look forward to it.
Yeah, my husband and I don't know if we'll get to see you, but we'll be on board.
Well, if you're on board, you come and talk to me.
Okay.
I'll be there. Thanks for calling.
You betcha. Bye.
Jim, when we walk on to Discovery 3, what do we see there? What will we be able to see? Will we be able to see an engine room?
The engine room is pretty well sealed up, and we have a film that we show. And incidentally, we have television on that boat. We have 7 big monitors on there so that people on all decks can see anything that occurs. The commentator, for example, is seen on all decks on this big video screen. And then you can see things ashore that we show with that. And yeah, we have seating area with unlimited visibility, unobstructed, all 3 decks. One deck is in the open air with a Texas deck up there and a little shelter on top, seating all around it. That boat is licensed for 1,000 people. However, we never carry more than 750 because we feel that we can entertain 750 in the manner that we want to. Any more than that's a little crowded, so we just don't do it. We'd rather make more trips.
You have a gift shop?
Yes, we have a fine gift shop.
Yeah.
And we have 2 snack bars on there. And it's big, and it's comfortable, and it's safe, and our sound system is terrific, and the video is good, and the crew just loves to do it. We have about 35 people that work with us. The village where we stop is an exciting place, and it really takes you back in time to the era that I've been talking about when I first got started here.
Jim, there are a couple of messages I have to get in here. One of them, I'd like to make a comment about this. This is the first time that I've ever had guests in to listen to the interview between one of the pioneers of Alaska on Alaska Gold Trails, and I appreciate them coming. Fact of the matter is, Oxford Assaying and Refining, I told them that I wasn't going to have a contest today, and they said, well, if you're going to have guests in on the show, we would like to have them each have one of our silver ingots. And so I have brought the silver ingot with me to give to the two guests that I have here today watching our interview, and it's been a real pleasure having you here. And I want you to know that I really appreciate your contribution to Alaska Gold Trail. Thank you, Jim Beekman.
Pleasure to be here. Our boat sails in about 3 minutes, and I'm going to be on it. So thank you, Jim. I've enjoyed being on your program.
Folks, this brings Alaska Gold Trails to another end. I want to thank you all for visiting with us today. Thanks so much for your phone calls. I really appreciate it. This is Jim Madonna on Alaska Gold Trails. Until next week, folks, happy prospecting.
Willow Woods is your key to affordable luxury in 1- and 2-bedroom apartments. Willow Woods, with walk-in closets, oversized bathrooms, fully equipped kitchens, and bathrooms.